Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome, everybody. It's the first show of the week. It is Tuesday. We are live on three different platforms. We're live on Speak Free Radio. We're live on Odyssey and GTV today. We got the GTV issues settled. It was just an update with the website that I had not been made aware of, so we should be good on that end. Welcome, everybody. I do not have a very vibrant or exciting schedule this week to go over. This week's schedule is going to be very basic. Let me just read it off. We're just doing basically regular streams all week. We'll be live tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll be live Thursday at 4, and then Friday at 5, and then Sunday, as usual, we have as to be determined. We'll set a day for the bar on the bottom right corner of the screen, and we'll go with that. We got quite a few people in here already on the Odyssey. I'll say hello to the folks in the Odyssey. We got Owie, welcome, brother, Mariner, Psychodrilla, Pure Nomad, Jack, and we got Commander Kevin. Warren, welcome. Welcome, everybody. My dog's losing his cool. Apologies for that. Okay, so again, don't forget we are live on Speak Free Radio, guys, if you guys are not already on there. It's just speakfreeradio.com. You guys can view the show over there. And for those who are on Speak Free Radio and are not familiar with my other platforms, my main streaming platform is Odyssey. I guess my main really is GTV, but I tend to be getting more viewers lately via Odyssey. So it's just odyssee.com. You can find me there if you would prefer to have a visual presentation of the show. You can see it there. And then my socials are Gab and Twitter, both at Logos Revealed. So don't forget to watch over there. We don't have any crazy exciting topics. I'm actually I'm very short on sleep today. So today's show is going to be a little less involved than the last three podcast streams we've had. Better topics to kind of philosophically endeavor into. This stream is not going to be as stimulating, I don't think. Let me actually pull up the clip that we had in mind, if you give me one second here. If we are capable of finding it. I also wanted to remind everybody while we're in here, we have a little less than 2 weeks left on the book club. If you guys are still interested in participating in the book club, make sure you contact me personally and I'll send you a private link in order to get into the book club chat. We do one book a month with a brief one-page report at the end of each month. So make sure that you guys participate, tag along in the endeavor. It's been a lot of fun so far. We're currently reading The Social Contract by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I'll actually show you guys the book for those watching on GTV and Odyssey. It's a very short book. It's 180 pages, but again, the introduction is 50 pages in itself, which I don't think I've seen many books with a 50-page introduction and then only 130 pages of the actual book. I'm not really a fan of an introduction being that long, so I'll be entirely honest, I did not read it, and I don't think I will. I'm very unhappy with the length of that. It's kind of like I'm reading a whole separate book compared to the size of this book. It's a good book, though. It's a, I guess political philosophy would be the best descriptor of the book. I do highly recommend. It's worth the read. It's quick and easy. I won't say easy, but it is a quick read. You know, Mariner, I think you did message me about that via Gab, right? You know, I have to be honest, I've been very bad at getting back to people lately on Gab. You know what? I do see it now. I'll have to respond to you there. But yeah, well, I hope you can end up pushing through and be able to participate. Your reports are always extremely solid. But in the event that you can't, I'll make sure that I at least show your book report on the stream that I'll do at the end of the or the beginning of the next month when I read off book reports. I'll make sure that I do yours just in case you are not going to be coming back. Let me see.
The lectures you're.
I want to do another Michael Sugrue video for those who I think you guys recall in the first, I think it was the first show we did. Actually, it might have been the second show. I think it was the second show. We covered Michael Sugrue discussing. We were doing the Republic. There's a video I want to go into. This actually isn't Michael Sugrue, but it's I guess a colleague of his whose videos are also uploaded onto the same channel. His name is Darren Staloff. It's Staloff. Not too familiar with him. But there's a very interesting video he's done. We're gonna try to play this here. I'll pull it up on the screen as well. And we'll do the same thing that we did in the second podcast stream. We're gonna go over this this video. I think this is hopefully a little bit stimulating. I'm not sure that it will be. If we don't like it about, you know, a couple minutes in, we can always swap to a better video. So this guy in this video is actually going to discuss Karl Marx's materialism. Now I've only watched the first 3 or 4 minutes of this, so I'm not sure how thought-provoking this is going to be. If it is something that is, we'll continue with it, and if it's not, we'll move on to something a little bit better. So, all right. Okay, again, we have a video up. We will be listening and watching. So for those that want to actually visually see, make sure you guys hop over onto GTV or Odyssey. You can see visually there. And if you guys are okay listening, then Speak Free Radio is the platform to go. All right, here we go, folks.
Karl Marx's historical materialism is one of the philosophic projects of the last two centuries that has irrevocably changed the nature not only of philosophic speculation, but obviously of geopolitical realities, of social struggles, and also of historical and sociological analysis. In many ways, Marxism is a very broadly synthetic intellectual project, bringing together elements of aesthetic theory, of moral theory, of epistemology, of metaphysics, much of which is very much, how to put it, dated. Marx is very much useful as a barometer of intellectual fashion. A romantic poet in his youth and a great student of positivist science when positivism was in fashion in the latter half of the century. Nonetheless, there is a certain core of Marx's oeuvre, or how to put it, a certain part of his project, which has retained a certain currency even to this day. And that, I would urge, is Marx's historical materialism, his interpretation of history, and his very rich sociological analysis. It is, even among people who would not consider themselves Marxists, strongly tinctured by Marxian analyses and Marxian posits. So what I'm going to try and give you here is to disentangle one certain thread of the whole project of Marxism, the historical materialism, and offer for you a rational reconstruction of it, which I have culled from reading a wide variety of his sources. I should begin by noting that Marx was profoundly affected by Hegelian philosophy, Kantian moral theory, French political communism, specifically of Babeuf, and British political economy. And towards the end of his life, that becomes increasingly important to him. He's very much eager to inherit the mantle of David Ricardo as the great political economist of his generation. Marx attempted to synthesize all of these disparate elements into one sort of overarching philosophy or worldview, much of which has become, as I've suggested, in many ways outdated. But his historical materialism, which has retained a certain amount of freshness and validity for us, is specifically an attempt to answer Hegel's idealist explanation of history, which you previously heard from Professor Segrou. In a way, Hegel was the perfect answer to the Enlightenment, right? We saw that the Enlightenment tended to push a mechanistic materialist metaphysic, which tried to treat Newtonian science as the bottom line explanation of the universe. And Hegel, of course, came across the way you always refute any scientific explanation, with a counterexample. You say, okay, if all of the world...
Yes, you know, his, again, this is a Darren Staloff. You know, I have to say his speaking style is not as captivating as Segrou's. You know, I think I'm actually going to swap video, and we're going to try a we're going to actually analyze something from Segrou specifically.
Lectures your...
I don't know, the Staloff is his speaking patterns. I'm not a fan of. It's hard to hone in on his points. Also, the audio is not exactly great in that. We're going back to Segrou. This is him discussing Nietzsche's critique of Christianity. I think this will be probably a little bit more stimulating. I'll have more to contribute as well for this. It is nice to hear them break down some of these Jewish communistic ideals, which they are opposed to, but they're opposed to in more of a polite manner, and they give kind of calm, quiet critiques rather than actually breaking down why these philosophies are really bad. They do it in a more intellectual manner. Holokov, with the 100 library coins, guys, can we get the Romans in the chat for Holokov? He says, white power. To be honest, it's his ponytail I can't stand. Wish I'd stuck to audio only. Yeah, we're going to move to Michael Sugru. He's a little bit better. He's a little bit better. That guy's not my favorite. Michael Sugru is a very interesting character. It's such a shame we lost him. I really wanted to get him on my show for an interview.
Friedrich Nietzsche is one of the most important philosophers in the tradition of Western thought. He's one of the most artistic and ruthless and fascinating individuals in the intellectual history of the West. He viewed himself as being the end of the Western intellectual tradition. He saw himself as the destroyer of metaphysics. He saw himself as the destroyer of Christianity. He saw himself as a combination philosopher-artist in the tradition.
That already is something I want to point out as well. A lot of people, I've seen quite a few in our circles try to state that Nietzsche was a Christian or appreciated Christianity, or he didn't dislike Christianity. He just disliked he was just putting critiques on all of the religions. But Nietzsche was very against Christianity. He speaks about it in pretty much all of his works, right? In Beyond Good and Evil, he actually has a work entitled The Antichrist, where he essentially plays the role of the Antichrist. It's a really interesting work as well, one I highly recommend that you read. It's like 80 pages. It's very short, but we know that Nietzsche, we talked about this actually in our second show, he talks about this concept of the Übermensch, which in English translates to overman or superman. Jews have subverted that concept of Superman with the comic book character, but this concept of the Übermensch, in Nietzsche's philosophy, you can't attain that character whilst being a Christian or having a Christian society, because Christianity teaches uplifting of all of the bad elements of society. So, you know, tolerating the crippled and the people that are in these bad spots that are not doing anything to benefit society as a whole. He considered it essentially a slave morality of consistently helping up the fellow man without actually... it's like an inverted morality, right? So in our real moral state, we want to help those who are actually beneficial to help, right? So, you know, if you're going to help somebody that is actually going to benefit the collective of society, then you're actually doing a greater moral good, right, on a larger scale. But if you help somebody who's like, you know, some crackhead on the street who's, you know, begging you for spare change, you might feel like because they really need it, you're helping them and you're doing a moral good. But in reality, you're most likely funding their drug habit. And secondly, you're taking assets that could be given to good functioning members of society that could better society. And you're now weeding them into the lowest denominator of society and essentially flushing them down the drain. So it's actually a large immoral, right? But if you ask a Christian, you know, who should you give money to? Your fellow Christian at church who isn't asking for it, who might, you know, be struggling behind the scenes? Or should you give it to, you know, that homeless crackhead on the corner? They're more likely to think that they should give it to the homeless crackhead on the corner. This is this inverted reality or morality that kind of states that, you know, these real low-life, low-level people need to be helped just because they're in a bad spot, and that's why they're deserving of it. It's just simply not the case, right? This is a inversion of a true morality. And Nietzsche speaks very vehemently against this, and this is probably one of his largest critiques about Christianity. I'm sure this will be covered here very shortly.
...of Plato, and he offered a comprehensive critique of the Western intellectual tradition, not conceived merely or narrowly as a philosophical tradition, but as a cultural tradition. Nietzsche, more than anyone else, was a philosopher of culture. He offered criticism of every element in Western culture, and his criticism is noteworthy for its refusal to compromise, for his insistence that we get to the psychological heart of things. What I'd like to talk about in this lecture is Nietzsche's treatment of Christianity and morality, two of the central questions for most philosophers in the Western tradition, and particularly important for Nietzsche because although he is something of a megalomaniac, there's a certain amount of truth to the argument that he is, in fact, the Antichrist. He, in fact, called himself the Antichrist more than once, and he wrote a book called The Antichrist. And what he hoped to do was to get beyond Christianity. He quite literally thought that he was going to supplant Jesus in the Western tradition, which is...
I also want to pick up, he said, you know, Nietzsche looked at, you know, these Western philosophers from history, not just as individual thinkers or philosophers in themselves, but he looked at it in a cultural aspect, which is actually really important, and it's very telling of really that Germanic character, right? The Germanics have this this deep understanding of racial consciousness, right? Obviously, that was very present in the early 1900s. Throughout all of Germany, right? They were very recognizant of the importance of that racial culture. Now, again, we expressed this in a show not long ago. Culture, people have to understand this, culture is a product of race, right? Without a race, you don't have a culture. So race is on the top of the ladder, then comes the culture, okay? So it's very important that we recognize that this Western philosophy, as Nietzsche is describing it, is our culture, right? It's not these ways of thought that we have, they're specific to our culture, and by extension, they're specific to our race, right? This is why when we go to Africa, they don't have philosophy. We go to China, they might have philosophy, but it's not in line with ours. They don't have the same thought process as us, right? We go to Mexico, they don't really have philosophy, and if they have it, again, it's not at all in line with ours. And then very specifically, which is the most important one, obviously, is when you go to Jewish theology, Jewish literature, Jewish culture, their philosophy, their worldview is literally the 100% inversion of ours. Everything we find as morality, they find as immorality. Everything we find as immoral, they find to be a great moral good. So we're complete opposites, right? And we have to recognize that the reason that someone like Nietzsche has his critiques for Christianity is because he recognizes the origins of it, right? So prior to Judaism expounding into the Western world or becoming a prominent factor in the Western world, all of these different civilizations had religions that were actually bound with their culture and with their civilization, right? So the Egyptians worshipped gods that were culturally specific to their civilization. The Romans worshipped gods that were culturally specific to theirs. The Greeks worshipped gods that were culturally specific to theirs. You'll see this in all of the ancient civilizations of the West. So Jews came in, they brought Judaism into the place, and then you get the figure of Jesus. Now, we can think of this many ways. You know, you can view Jesus, the problem is this is very interpretable. So you can view Jesus as a Jew who came and said, you know, I don't like what these Jews are doing. I want to reform them away from this behavior and create something different. That it's an extension of Judaism because it believes in this mono God, right? There's only one God, this universal God. When all the other civilizations were polygods, right? There was multiple gods that represented different aspects of the culture. So you could view Jesus in that light. You could view Jesus as a Gentile who said, wow, I'm reading up on these Jewish books and I really don't like what they're doing. I got to stop this. So let me create something new that might be able to drag them away from this culture that they have, right? You can view him any way you want. I mean, you can view him as a subversive element who wanted to put Christianity amongst the Gentiles and put them into this slave morality that Nietzsche theorizes that that we are a part of. So there's all these different interpretations. This is the problem, right? There's no solid basis that says this 100% is what happened and this is why Christianity is here. But what is certain, what can't be debated or denied, is that without Judaism, we would not have Christianity. So Judaism created this school of thought. Christianity compounded on this school of thought, refuted the actions and behaviors of the original creators of the school of thought, and said, we want to drag it in this direction, right? So this is a... The problem is this of our culture? Is this not of our culture? It's impossible to actually tell. So what Nietzsche does in his works is explain that he explains our philosophical culture, right? As we discussed, philosophy is a part of our culture, an extension of our culture. So he explains our philosophical culture and then compares it to Christianity and shows how they're kind of incongruent. They do not complement each other. So we'll allow him to continue further, and you'll see how he'll express this.
It's quite a tall order. Not many people have that sort of ambition. But Nietzsche was never a shrinking violet. And in fact, he wanted to offer a new set of values. He wished to offer a new cultural orientation to the West, or perhaps to revive an old cultural orientation in the West. And he wished to make us confront the half-truths, the lies, the evasions that are characteristic of almost everyone's life and thought. Now, he wrote several books that criticized morality. In some respects, the tradition of Western ethics is his main target. And perhaps the most intriguing of these books, or one of the most intriguing of these books, is called Beyond Good and Evil. Now, getting beyond good and evil is a rather...
Also, Holokov, you asked, what Nietzsche books do I recommend? Sorry, I just saw that in the chat room. The three that I... Actually, they're probably all going to be discussed in this. The three that I look upon as the greatest, Beyond Good and Evil is one, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and The Antichrist. The Antichrist is the shortest, and it's very interesting, his takes. If you are a Christian and you're questioning Christianity, I would highly recommend reading that. It will maybe formulate a few extra thoughts in your mind. Beyond Good and Evil is the second shortest. That one is a very interesting one. That's where he goes into the concept of the Übermensch, more in depth, talks about the higher man and how our morality, right? Our morality is beyond good and evil. That's why the title of the book is there, right? So what's interesting is all these philosophies play a part in each other, and this is why you have to understand. Again, we talked about this on the second one, and I probably sound like a broken record at this point, but it's very important that you understand. This is a very subversive element, this comic book character of Superman, okay? Because this comic book character, who is supposed to represent the Superman or the Übermensch, right, is a Jewish version, a Jewish philosophical and cultural version of the Übermensch, okay? When Nietzsche writes about the Übermensch, he writes his, which is the Aryan conception and philosophical cultural belief that the Übermensch is. So in Nietzsche's worldview, which is the Aryan worldview, the Superman is beyond these basic concepts of good and evil, this base level morality, right? But in the Jewish philosophy, in their Jewish thought process of the Superman, they view it as, no, it's inextricably bound up with good and evil, right? So Superman is the good guy fighting evil, right? They literally are formulating in the minds of our youth, in our nations, what good and evil is, okay? You have to understand how deep that subversion goes. So you grow up getting this Jewish version, this Jewish philosophical worldview and tradition of what good and evil is, right? Which is their level of morality, their scheme of morality, right? And because people are growing up and getting this, this is why you get these... I go to somebody and I say, oh, well, you know, I kind of think Hitler did some good things. You want to discuss something about Hitler? And they go, oh, God, you can't even say his name. You can't say his name, right? It's he's evil. He's got the evil label, right? So it's everything in this... In this Jewish worldview, which has now been given to the goy, really, really overly in America, but it's seeding its way everywhere else, this worldview has become completely enthralled with our people. So now our people go, oh, everything is looked through the light of good and evil. So if this guy is evil, you can't compliment him. You can't discuss that he might have done something good. He's been defined as evil. No good can come from evil, right? It's one or the other. It's black and white, right? In the Aryan worldview, this good and evil thing, it's a balance scale, right? So, for instance, I hate to call this person out, but there's a guy within our movement. He's on Twitter. His name is like 9mm something. He made this post one day, and I'm not calling him out specifically, but you know, if he ever sees this, this might help him to understand the error of his thought or the Jewishness of this thought. He said, aborting a baby that you know is going to have Down syndrome is inherently evil, okay? No matter what, it is evil. This is wrong, okay? Because, again, this is looking at things in black and white. This is just looking at it as killing is evil. Killing is evil, right? It's the same thing as saying the death penalty is inherently evil. We shouldn't kill anybody. Okay, well, what if this person is a serial child rapist who's raped and killed several children and will most likely do it again? You don't think we should death penalty that person? Truly, right? Because you think it's evil to kill. Well, here's the thing. If you kill for the benefit of the collective so that less will die on a long-term scale, this is not, it's no longer evil to kill. It's now a act of goodness to kill because you're protecting by killing, right? So good and evil in this Jewish framework is super black and white. It's one way or the other. There's no different, right? Same with, look how much this is actually seeded into our politics now, right? It's demoralized even our political atmosphere. You have people, I might say, you know, I don't like this Biden guy. He's old, decrepit. I mean, look at him. He's losing his mind. So now in their mind, they think because they're stuck up in this, it's good and evil. It's one way or the other, completely polar. They say, oh, you don't like Biden? Well, look at Trump. He's this, he's that. You get this reactionary response because if you think Biden is evil, in their eyes, you must think Trump is good. They're incapable of thinking out of this framework that it's good or bad. They can't think outside of that. They don't realize, oh, wait, some things are actually balanced and more nuanced than just it's good or bad, right? Some things actually dig deeper. People in specifically in America, you see this very badly. But it is unfortunately seeding its way into all of the Western world. So we need to fix this. We have a cultural shift that has to be fixed. And we've been so heavily subverted in so many sectors. Most are completely incognizant of how bad this is. It is so bad. It is all the way down to the way you actually think intrinsically has been subverted. You don't even know it until you actually analyze these things and re-educate yourself on what it means to think like an Aryan. You can't just, here's the thing. Because it's your culture, right, and it's your philosophical background, if you lived in an ethnostate with all of your people, you would naturally think like an Aryan because everybody within that society would be on that framework, in that thought process, right? But now that we are living in a society that is 100% grasped and controlled and Judaized, now you are only able to think in the Jewish framework by nature because it's all you see around you, right? Now, some people there is something in that spirit that tells them this isn't right. This doesn't feel correct. This isn't normal to me. This isn't natural. And this is where we get people, you know, looking into these things, trying to figure things out, the awakening, so to speak, right? What are you awakening to? Well, you're not just awakening to there's Jews in my country, right? Or Jews run my government. That's very base level. What you're awakening to is what the repercussions of this not only are now, but what they have been in the past and what it's created for, again, not just how society is. It's not just, oh, I hate that I have, you know, three black neighbors here and a Puerto Rican neighbor over here. It's not that, right? It goes deeper. It's look at the way they're making your family act. Look at the way that they're tearing your family apart. Look how they're making your family think, right? Look how they're making your family and your community feel. Look at these things on a deeper level, and then you recognize how bad this situation actually is, and it empowers you to want to actually fix it. That's true awakening. That's the awakening of the spirit. It's not just a lot of people think, oh, you know, I'm red-pilled, based in red-pilled. I know Jews run my government. It goes so far beyond that. Sorry, a little tangent there. Crackerbolts88 with a $5 investment. He says, that's why I ask my kids what they talked about every day after school so I can correct it, at least until I get them into homeschooling. Very good, brother. I mean, you have to. Unfortunately, it's a huge shame that this is the circumstance we're in, but good on you for doing that, truly. Make sure you guys get the Romans in the chat for Crackerbolt. Thank you so much for the investment. I greatly appreciate it. Let's continue on here. I'm talking more than Michael is.
Another unusual activity for a philosopher, particularly one concerned with morals. But Nietzsche wants to take an extremely skeptical, an extremely naturalistic approach to moral theory and moral valuation. And he wishes to offer a criticism of Christianity and the values that it represents, and in addition, to supplant that with a new code of morals. Nietzsche asks an important question. Question that everyone living in this modern age, this one-world, anti-metaphysical age, has to confront, which is, where does Christianity and its moral values come from? How is it that human beings, conceived of as animals, as featherless bipeds, how is it that they come to have a thing called a conscience? How is it that they make judgments of good and evil, which is not characteristic of fish or birds or reptiles? What is it about human beings which causes them to construct moral systems which are in some respects the antithesis of nature? Why is it that we feel the desire to conflict with nature and make judgments that nature never does? Nietzsche thinks that he finds the answer in the psyche of the human individual, and he thinks that we are very peculiar animals, animals with strange attributes which are which are natural and which are part of the human condition. But in fact, Nietzsche says that most of our elevation of ourselves beyond nature, beyond simple facticity, is a kind of spurious raising of ourselves outside of and above nature. The German term for this is Sonderstellung. What that means is other position, a position somehow outside of nature. Nietzsche wants us to confront the fact that we are animals, that we are part of nature, and that our moral judgments are, in fact, part of that natural process. In looking at Christianity, Nietzsche goes back to the actual history of Christianity and asks, what is it that Christian morals represent? Whose interests do they serve? And why are these interests disguised? What is it about the moral judgments characteristic of Christianity that needs to be disguised?
I just want to say we got some more support coming in. I don't know how to say your name because it's just dot, dot, dot on my screen, but with a $5 investment, thank you very much for that support. Let's get the Romans in the chat for him, guys. He says, read the short, A Real Case Against the Jews by Marcus Eli Ravage. It shows what Christianity has done to whites. Would make for a great video with amazing quotes. All right, let me actually save that right now. I'm actually not familiar with that work. I'll save that, and one of these days I'll cover this on my show. Thank you very much, both for the recommendation and the support to the show. Make sure you guys get the Romans up for him. And then Mariner with a $5 investment as well. He says, A Real Case Against the Jews. Oh, it's a link. A Jew bragging about conquering Europe without swords. Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. Romans in the chat for both Mariner and dot, dot, dot. It's what it says on my screen, unfortunately. Yeah, I'll definitely look into both of those. I'll actually save this BitChute clip right now. Okay, great. All right, let's continue forward.
What is it that, in other words, that's a lie in Christian morals? Remarkable question. Nietzsche's answer is that there are two kinds of morality, and Christianity only represents one particular perspective on judgments of good and evil. And this perspective is the perspective of the herd. Nietzsche contrasts two kinds of morals. Herd morals, morals that are characteristic of the weak, the feeble, the inferior, the enslaved, which is to say Christianity, and master morals, morals of warriors, the predatory human beings, who make judgments on the basis of their strength rather than their weakness. Nietzsche wishes to supplant the herd morals, characteristic of Christianity, characteristic of Western culture for the previous 2,000 years, with a new morals, morals that harkens back to the age of the Homeric hero, which harkens back to the aristocratic warrior elite, which is found all over the world, which creates values out of nothing, and which glories in the fact that their judgments can be enforced in this world, independent of any metaphysical construct. Now, Nietzsche asks, who was it that created Christianity? Well, it's an outgrowth of Judaism, and Judaism is a priestly religion. Christianity is an extension of that. And Christianity, in its earliest historical phases, appeals to the slave class in Rome. In fact, Christianity is the revolt of the oppressed masses in Rome. And Nietzsche argues that Christianity and its myths was organized so as to articulate the perspective of the slaves, of the inferior, of the feeble, and it was a way of having revenge upon masters, having revenge upon warriors, having revenge upon those who could oppress them, and turning the tables by offering a scale of values that was different from and independent of the master class. Nietzsche says that the slaves have their revenge, and the triumph of Christianity in the West amounts to the triumph of the slave, of the inferior, of the weak and impoverished. Think about the ideas or the myths that underlie Christianity. The idea that even in this world, if there's no justice, there's another world.
A real case against the Jews. One of them points out the...
My apologies, I opened up that link.
Heaven and hell, where God's eternal justice gives everyone what they deserve. Nietzsche says that what this in fact is the frustration, the impotence, the anger of slaves transformed into a myth which allows them to get their revenge on those that oppress them, if not in this world, at least in an unreal world.
Good recognition, by the way, Jag in the chat. He says, the way he puts it, it sounds like Marxism. Yeah, well, because, again, this is the cultural spirit of the Jew. It is revolutionary. So even if it's Christianity, if it's Marxism, if it's communism, if it's BLM, no matter what Jews create, no matter what they found in a nation, it will always be revolutionary against that nation, right? I mean, even when you read the Old Testament, they did this in ancient Egypt, right? They were revolting. Same with Babylon, right? Oh, they were oppressed in Babylon, and they had to revolt, right? It's time and time again, every Jewish story is about Jews revolting, Jews having a massive revolution. It's a constant cycle of the victim, quote-unquote, revolting against the oppressor, quote-unquote. Meanwhile, if their nature is so opposite us that they don't recognize or want to recognize that they could create their own civilization, be amongst themselves, not be bothered by us, not have to be oppressed by us, they choose to not do these things. And that's their own fault. But it is their culture. It's just how they are bound up, the same way that we are bound up to actually do that. We're just so opposite fundamentally on every single level. It's very hard to even express sometimes.
Which offers them some solace in a world of pain and misery. Nietzsche contrasts the morality of Christianity with the morality of the Romans. The Romans were fierce, independent, warlike men who made their own scale of values based upon power, based upon the desire to dominate, and they showed no reluctance to inflict pain on those they viewed as inferior. And here, inferior means not morally inferior in the Christian sense, but physically inferior in terms of practical strength. Nietzsche's new alternative to Christianity will be a resuscitation of the warlike values of the ancient world. And what he hopes will come out of this will be an evaluation of Christianity which allows us to get beyond Christianity. And the one who is going to succeed Christ as the central figure in Western moral theory will be Nietzsche himself. He frequently signed himself as the Antichrist or as Dionysus, another incarnation of the Nietzschean judgment of good and evil. And in doing this, he raises very disturbing questions about the kind of moral judgments that we make that are still characteristic of this culture, and the difficulty of maintaining the traditional judgments of good and evil, characteristic of the West, in an age in which religion and theology are taken less and less seriously. Now, let's think about the idea of getting beyond good and evil. Nietzsche contrasts the slave and the master moralities, and he says what's characteristic of Christianity is the distinction between good and evil. Good, in the Christian sense, means kindness, lovingness, pity, essentially. Nietzsche thinks that Christian morality is a morality of pity, which raises to a spurious level of distinction feeling for the weak, the inferior, and the impoverished. We might contrast this with the master morality, which doesn't distinguish between good and evil. In fact, it distinguishes between good and bad, in the sense of capable or incapable, potent or impotent. That's a totally different judgment of value from that characteristic of Christianity. And in fact, this is the scale of values, this master morality, is the one which Nietzsche expects will produce the highest type of human being. Nietzsche holds the view, which at least in part is borrowed from Darwin, that human beings have no intrinsic value. If you remember that one of the great breakthroughs, or one of the great contributions of Christianity to the West, is the idea that all souls are equal in the sight of God, and that all people are equally valuable on some level, regardless of what their particular skills or capacities are. Well, Nietzsche says that's a mistake. What that is the revenge of those that can't do anything. And Nietzsche says, if we are ever going to produce anything great in this culture, if we are ever going to produce anything significant in this culture, we must get away from the idea that other people really matter. The only elements in the human species which are important are the half dozen great geniuses in any culture. And he says that Christianity inhibits the development of genius. It inhibits the development of creativity because it is envious. It is a way of mythologizing the envy of those that are incapable, of those that are not, that don't have much in the way of capacity. And Nietzsche says if we are to get beyond that, then we must get beyond this morality of pity. We must get beyond good and evil, back or forward, if you want, to the idea that good and bad are the main standards of our moral judgment.
So again, as we were just expressing earlier, it's this idea that Christianity, and it's not just Christianity, again, even within America, right? Now, we can also state that because it's a Christian nation, it was easier for them to subvert that morality. But we've described how they've used things such as pornography, such as, to an extent, let's actually go into this. So pornography now, if you go ask the average 15 to 20-year-old guy, do you watch porn? They'll go, yeah, sure, of course. Like, there's no shame. They don't recognize it as an evil because it's not in that good and bad scale, right? Society doesn't put it in the good and bad, right? They used to do this. When it was actually Christian, right? They recognized those things as bad or sinful, and they were able to then take measures against that, right? But then because this is this softness that has kind of tumbled itself over with it, we now get this this piece where we just accept when people come in and say, you know, well, I want to do this and I want to do that, and well, it's your prerogative, right? This comes with this all souls are equal thing, right? It's your thing. As long as you're happy, we're all free, happy individuals, and just do what we want, kind of a thing. It kind of gets into like hippy dippy kind of stuff, but the idea that what he expressed here that Nietzsche feels that real advancement in culture and life and the only thing that really matters is these a few dozen genuine geniuses who come to the forefront and manipulate cultural change, right? I mean, again, let's look back at ancient Rome, right? There were millions of Romans that existed. How many do you know? A couple dozen, right? Let's look back at National Socialist Germany. There were probably hundreds of thousands of really brilliant guys in the ranks that were doing great things in that civilization. How many do you know? A couple dozen, right? There's always that group that will shine above the rest, right? And that shows you that we're not born with this equal ability, right? Because to say that all our souls are equal then insinuates that we all have equal ability, right? And that's just simply not true, right? I don't have the same ability as some five-year-olds on the fucking piano, right? Some five-year-olds can sit down and just rip it on a piano and do so good it's not even funny. They can do all of Moonlight Sonata, right? No problem. All three stanzas, right? I can't even start the first 30 seconds, okay? So talents are a proof, right? Natural talents are a proof of this concept that we are not all born on this equal plane, this equal playing field. And to think otherwise harms us because we look at somebody who is actually lesser and we fail to, we refuse to recognize the fact that that person might be lesser. This is where we get into this issue with racism, right? So now when we have this, we here have this real morality where we look at race on a logical scale. We're not looking at it as good or evil, right? We're looking at it on a logical scale and we're saying blacks have a lower IQ on mass scale. They are incapable of producing societies in the way that we are. They are incompatible with our societies because they do not live as civilized as we do. This is factual, and because of that, I don't want them near me because I don't want more conflict to arise from us being so incompatible, right? So in this this distorted worldview, it's, well, you can't look at them as lesser than you just because they're black. That's evil, right? It's the same concept, right? Racism is evil. White supremacy, quote-unquote, is evil, right? To recognize logically and factually that white people have produced more collectively for the planet than any other group, right, have invented way more, have done way more, have achieved way more. Who got to the moon? Who took us to the moon, right? Actually, even if you believe that, I don't know if I even believe that nonsense. That goes deeper. But point is, we've achieved far more, right? So we could use the word supreme if we want. They've heavily subverted this word. But in reality, we are a higher race. Whether you want to recognize that consciously or not is your choice. But people are scared to consciously recognize it because to insinuate you're higher means they must be lower. Therefore, you're evil because you think negatively of them. But that's this mindset that we're stuck in. I've experienced this with individuals in my life. You know, you make an observation, and because that observation recognizes a negative trait of the person, instantly you're attacking them, and they feel like it's evil and rude and awful. But they're not recognizing that. No, I'm not. Look at my demeanor. I'm not attacking you. I'm telling you what you're doing here is actually really bad. I'm just trying to actually point it out for you so that you recognize these things. Right. Let's give another example. One more example of good and evil. Why this is a problem. Let's look at kids in school. Right, we got the fag and the obese person and the tranny and the idiot. Right, so now all these people get made fun of. Right, they get quote unquote bullied. This is another heavily subverted term that we've come across. That's been deeply grained into society. Well, a bully is evil because they hurt people's feelings. They're mean to somebody, so instantly they're evil no matter what. Well, if you tell somebody, "Hey, you're obese. It's disgusting." You're that's not evil. You're helping them. You're saying the state you're in is unnatural. It's unhealthy for you, and it's going to harm you in the long run. I'm helping you. I'm doing you a favor, right? Oh, this guy's a faggot, right? Well, oh, that's evil. That's a mean word, right? Well, you know what? What he's doing is actually evil towards nature and towards himself because he can't reproduce, okay? And he'll never understand the true fulfillment of the purpose of life because he'll never experience it. There's all of these, you know what I mean? It goes so deep. Let me catch up on the chats here. I'm falling behind. Holokoff with the 25 library coins. Can we get the Romans in the chat for Holokoff? He says, I liked what the Blood Tribe guy said you had on recently. I guess that would be Nate. that if you weren't anti, if they weren't anti-white, they'd be untouchable, but they can't help themselves, even to their own detriment. Yeah, it's Jewish behavior. It's in their nature. It's absolutely in their nature. Yeah, that's a good point. This idea that any race can be Christian is was insanity. Or is insanity. Yeah, and again, there's offshoots of Christianity, to clarify as well. It's not that all Christians are of this, but the ideals push this, right? So this is where you get a lot of the older kind of Christians who are comfortable with, like, you know, literally watching their extinction go down in front of them. It's very interesting. Chat is very active today. Sorry, I'm having a hard time catching up for once. That doesn't happen often. Well said, well said. Michael, with a $5 investment, thank you very much. Can we get the Romans in the chat for Michael? Thank you so much, my friend. He said, bullying is bad, shaming is good. Bullying and shaming are conflated as being one and the same. They are not. See, here's the thing. I have a problem with the word bullying even existing, okay? Bullying, there's no root origin of the word, okay? Like, it doesn't have a root anywhere. I don't even know where this word comes from. I've tried very hard to look into this. I despise this word because it only has modern public conceptions, and it's almost always intrinsically bound up with children. It's very odd when I see someone say, oh, you know, like an adult saying, oh, I went on that guy's show and he bullied me. It's very odd. I don't understand. Yeah, Mariner, that's worded very well. He says, I can't hate Christianity as a whole. Many of my ancestors were Christian and I revere the best of them. I cannot hate them just because I disagree with their dogma. Exactly, exactly. You know, show them why you disagree and come to a conclusion that's beneficial for both. I don't think it's necessary to be vehemently against them. I'm quite surprised. Over in the GTV chat, we have actually people on in the more Christian side of thought, and in Odyssey we have the polar opposite. I think I would have expected it to be the other way. Yeah, maybe next time. That's a good point as well. There is quite a feminine nature to it, certainly. All right, let's continue onward. Again, we can all have disagreements. We're welcome to have different opposing views. Just make sure we're respectable with each other about it.
So there will be none of the conscientiousness characteristic of Christianity, none of the worry about heaven and hell, about God's judgment. This good and bad morality, this master morality, will be strictly oriented towards this world. It will not be caught up with the problem of conscience. It will not primarily be concerned with the state of one's soul so much as it will be concerned with the state of one's achievements. Nietzsche's judgment of good and bad, this master morality, is oriented towards doing things. The masters are those that achieve. And this is not necessarily to be taken in a political sense, although it can be taken in a political sense. Master moralities can also be the moralities of the artist. Master moralities can also be the morality of the thinker. But it has to be the kind of thinker or the kind of artist who despises mere mediocrity, who wants to go beyond and formulate something in this world that creates a justification for his entire society.
I just want to point out quickly that if you look at National Socialist Germany, they did an incredible job at actually reconciling the two, right? This Aryan original morality, right, and the Christian version of morality, both of them were reconciled extremely well in a National Socialist society. They did a very good job at that. It's actually quite commendable how good they did at kind of paying homage to both of those cultural backgrounds and making sure that both were kind of putting their foot into the door. Michael with another $5 investment. Thank you so much. You guys have been crazy supportive on the Odyssey. Thank you, my friend. Make sure you guys get the Romans in the chat. Be as kind to him as he's being to you. He says, my take on the Christian-heathen divide with the Gab post. Okay, let me actually just pull this up. Okay, fair enough. I don't see anything wrong with that. Yeah, my biggest problem, and this isn't with Christianity, but it's with the state of Christianity. So to express this, it's not Christianity as a dogma or as a doctrine, it's actually the state that Christianity is in today. The churches don't represent the original ideals. The morality is no longer preached. I have a very large problem with the state of Christianity. What it's become. Unfortunately, it's been heavily subverted. Holokov with 100 library coins. He says, in the UK, there was this national anti-bullying campaign. Lots of sheep were wearing these bracelets. This guy in my local pub I didn't like was wearing one. I kept punching him in the arm, and he said, what's your problem? I said, your anti-bully bracelet's not working. Thank you, brother. Can we get the Romans in the chat for both Holokov and Michael? Thank you guys so much for the very kind support. And yeah, I mean, I hate the bullying thing. I really do. It's the term, everything about it is insanity.
As Nietzsche says, in the use and abuse of history.
Yeah, ephemeral. I mean, it's that they were capable of pulling Christians into their camp, right? And even though a lot of their doctrine is opposed to Christian doctrine, they were capable of pulling them into their camp and making ends meet together. It's very interesting.
Mankind can only be judged by its highest examples. The average human being has no value whatever. Now, Nietzsche also inquires into the differences between the warrior aristocrat who generates the master morality and the priest. And the psychology of the priest is of great concern to Nietzsche. Nietzsche believes that the priestly type and the warrior aristocrat are both, in fact, superior kinds of men. One type is the individual, the Nietzschean hero, who's going to adopt the master morality. The most dangerous opponent to the Nietzschean hero, the man who adopts this master morality, is the priest. The priest is the opposite of the warrior type. And Nietzsche believes that the origin of this distinction lies in the human psyche, that psychological differences are what distinguish these two. Now, both the warrior and the priest have different kinds of the will to power. They just express this will to power differently. Nietzsche thinks, in fact, that all human beings can be characterized by their desire to dominate themselves, to dominate their environment, and to dominate other people. This puts Nietzsche squarely in the tradition of the sophists, if you think of Callicles and Gorgias in the Platonic dialogues. He's also in the line of Machiavelli, Sade, all of those people who adopt an atheistic perspective and who believe that human life is caught up with the desire to dominate others and to satisfy one's desires to the maximum extent. Nietzsche supports that idea. Now, the warrior does it in a very straightforward way. The warrior takes what he wants without any qualms of conscience. Conscience is an afterthought, invented at a much later date. The warrior just comes in and does what he does because that is his nature.
So again, why I brought up that it's quite incredible what National Socialist Germany was capable of doing is they quite literally preached might is right, right? Which is this Nietzschean concept, right? This Übermensch concept. It really is when you read enough cultural background and history and recognize how much culture the National Socialists were able to actually pull into one worldview. They were taking every piece of it and pulling it all into one very finely wrapped blanket. It's quite incredible. It really is.
The strong and the weak is the natural distinction. Good and evil is an anti-natural distinction. And if you think about it, there may be a certain grain of truth in this. Think of it this way. Think of the distinction between hawks and sparrows. Sparrows eat grains or seeds or whatever, and they're inoffensive birds, and there are quite many of them. But in fact, there's nothing better about eating what sparrows eat as compared to what hawks eat. We don't make moral judgments about hawks and say that they ought not to eat sparrows. We just recognize that in nature, different things feed in different ways, and predatory behavior is no worse and no better than any other behavior. Nature just is what it is. Nietzsche wants to force us.
Right. Let's give another example of this, as he just put across. Excuse me. Let's think about a bird, for example. If a mother bird hatches a bunch of baby birds in her nest, and one of those baby birds has a fucked up wing, and they're going to fly south. Those birds will actually kick that baby bird out of the nest and then fly south. They will leave it for dead, right? Now, does this mean that birds are evil? Does this mean birds are intrinsically evil and we have to stop birds from doing these things, right? It's just nature. They're recognizing that this one is weak. It's going to hold us back, and we will die if we keep towing the line for this one. You understand? No, I will not wear robes and cloaks. I'm quite happy with the way I dress. Thank you.
Back into nature. He wants us to reevaluate our disapproval of the human hawks. In fact, Nietzsche thinks that we have no more right to judge a warrior or an aristocrat evil than we have a right to judge a hawk evil. And he, in fact, thinks it doesn't make any more sense. The world of nature, red and fang and claw, just is what it is. And as Nietzsche puts it in a beautiful passage, he says, there are no moral phenomena. There are only moral interpretations of phenomena. A very profound idea. Well, whose values are built into Christianity? The values of the herd, the values...
Brother, thank you so much. Very kind. PM Cham with a $25 donation. Thank you so much, brother. Guys, can we get the Romans in the chat for PM Chan? You guys have really been seeming to like these podcast streams. I gotta say, the support has been wild, and I will say it's very thought-provoking. These conversations are always great. Thank you again. I really do appreciate it, guys. Truly. Make sure you guys get the Romans in the chat for PM Chan. Thank you so much, my friend.
Use of the week.
By the way, we are a little bit over that halfway point. I neglected to take the break because the conversation is going so well. So typically I would take a break and then we would just really quickly promote all our things. So we'll just really briefly promote our stuff. Don't forget, guys, if you are watching on any of these streams, whether it's on GTV, Odyssey, or Speak Free Radio. If you guys want to contact me personally or get up to date with the things that I'm doing, you can follow me on Twitter or on Gab, at Logos Revealed. On Twitter, it's actually at Logos Revealed with an I at the end of it. And then for those who are on Speak Free Radio and don't know about the other platforms, we are on GoyamTV.com at Logos Revealed, and we're also on Odyssey, ODYSEE.com at Logos Revealed. We've got quite a Rolodex of videos on the Odyssey channel, so if you guys want to check anything out, see the things that I've done in the past, there's plenty on there if you are interested. Additionally, if you guys do want to support this stream and keep it going, just like my friend PM Chan has done, you guys can do that through the links in the description on both GTV and Odyssey. There is a Bitcoin wallets, or crypto wallets rather, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, whatever. There's also Entropy. You can donate through Entropy, and that will give you the ability to actually have an alert that comes up on the screen with a message. And additionally, you can support straight through Odyssey, which seems to be the most simple way of doing it and the way that most people like. But there are all those other options just for everyone's convenience. So thank you guys again for the support. It very much helps me keep this going and do this full time so I can bring you, it's not a, books aren't free, nothing's free in this world. You know, I have to read these things. I have to, and also I have to have some kind of stable income so that I can comfortably read these things and not have to, you know, do all kinds of other things as well. And I can bring this to you guys and hopefully we can better ourselves all as a collective. So thank you guys again. I really do appreciate it. I hate to even say it. It's annoying. I every time I feel Jewish, I don't like promoting things. But unfortunately, that's the way these things work. So I have to do so. So thank you guys again for everybody that's been doing the support. All right, we got about 40 minutes left on the show, guys. We're going to continue with Michael Sugrue. Let him keep making some brilliant intellectual points.
And that's why it caught on among the underclass in Rome. And the entire history of Western ethics has been extrapolations from this herd morality, which has inhibited the development of our culture. If we were to go beyond that, we would have to allow for the fact that cruelty may not be an evil, that pity may be a vice, that the desire to dominate other people may be the highest expression of human being rather than its worst example. And in that respect, Nietzsche is not only connected to Machiavelli and to Sade and to the Sophists, but if any of you are familiar with the work of Dostoevsky, particularly something like Crime and Punishment, the idea of the singular man, the man that's...
It's incredible how all of these books that we have set for the book club this year just keep getting referenced, cross-referenced all over the place. So we will be reading Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, by the way, folks. And if you are not familiar, Dostoevsky also has some brilliant quotes about the Jews.
Going to stand outside of good and evil. Remember, Raskolnikov commits that murder. Much the same issues are being discussed in that novel. The question of whether, in fact, moral judgment is universal, or whether it's an arbitrary series of conventions designed by the weak to oppress the strong, strangely enough. Now, in a book called The Genealogy of Morals, he tries to figure out how it is we got into this predicament, how it is we came to the point where the inferior and the weak could start to make our moral judgments. And he says, first of all, that the initial moral judgments that human beings made came from the warrior aristocrats who imposed their will on the world. This is not only his model of the warrior aristocrat, it's also in some respects his model of the artist. Think about, and his arguments are very interesting. Nietzsche was a philologist and a professor of classical languages, and he derives most of his arguments from an inquiry into Latin and German words and what their origins might have been. Now, since I can't presuppose that you know Latin and German, let's try English just to see if, in fact, there's some evidence for this, and I think there is. Think about what a noble action is. What makes an action noble? Well, we know that a noble action is a good one. I mean, if you look it up in the dictionary, you'll find that it's a term of approval. Is it coincidental that nobility is also a section of the social structure in ancient societies?
It's driving me nuts. Some Jew in the crowd listening to this this lecture is like squeaking the hell out of his desk or chair. I'm sure you guys hear it in the background. It's like only in my right earphone. It's very frustrating.
consider the distinction between a noble action and a base action. Who do you think the base are? The base are, in fact, the inferior, the weak, those that take orders rather than give them. The distinction between noble and base suggests that maybe our judgments of value at the time when these words were coined are, in fact, simply the judgments of important warriors, contrasted with the judgments of people that have to suffer and put up with them. Consider the distinction between being mean and being noble. Well, being mean is a very bad thing nowadays, to be mean, but there was a time when to be mean meant that you were essentially a villain. Villain means peasant in its origins. Give that some thought. Nietzsche has a very profound argument here.
Interesting. This is something I actually did not know. Villain means peasant. Wow. Very interesting. Learn something new every day. Villain means peasant. Did not know that. Did not know that. That's the origin of the word villain.
Think about something like coming from a good family and coming from a bad family. Yes, indeed. Again, the judgments of power, characteristic of predatory warrior aristocrats, were the actual source, according to Nietzsche, of our judgments of good and evil. To be mean, to be base, to be a villain meant that you were bad. To be noble, to be high-minded as opposed to low-minded, to have high moral standards as opposed to low moral standards, ask yourself where they came from. Nietzsche was the first man to force himself to consider the possibility that what we take to be universal moral distinctions applicable to everyone are in fact a disguised form of the will to power, a way for the weak and the impotent to get back at the superior by changing these aristocratic valuations, by moving from good and bad to good and evil. In other words, the invention of evil was a way for the oppressed to strike back at the superior. Nietzsche wants to erase that. He says that's a mistake in Western culture. That's it's a hole or a gap or an inferior part of the Western tradition. And if we want to produce superior...
In the chat, we got Spy Hunter says, with a very generous $10 investment, can we get the Romans in the chat for Spy Hunter? He says, hail logic revealed. I think I'm going to hang out here for a while, if that's okay. Of course, welcome. Thank you very much, first off, for chatting, spending the time, and for supporting the show. Thank you so much, brother. Greatly appreciate that. Make sure you guys throw the Romans up in the chat for him. Thank you, my friend.
Human beings, then we have to free them from the shackles of slave morality. We have to prevent them from being undermined in their achievements or undermined in their aspirations by creating in them the conscience, a conscience which prevents them from achieving what they could. Now, here's another very interesting question, and it's very hard to answer. Nietzsche offers us a very provocative conception. Where does conscience come from, and what is it? Think about that for a moment. If, in fact, human beings are animals, and I think that Darwin has conclusively shown that to be the case, why are we the only animal with a conscience, and where does it come from, and what is it? Very difficult question. Nietzsche's argument is something like this. Human beings have a natural desire to achieve power. They have the will to power. That is characteristic of what makes people go. And the usual route that the will to power takes is the desire to dominate other people. There is a natural ruthlessness in people, a desire to take advantage of others, and it pleases people to cause pain. Hard thing for us to swallow, perhaps, in these days, but with the degree of pain in the world and the degree of evil that we see, to use a word that I might italicize, there may well be...
Yeah, Natsok, I mean, that's a decent way of wording it. It's not... It's not, yeah, that's probably the best way to word it. It's not evil, it's bad, right? It's not a good situation, something we would not prefer, right? But it's not evil. It's not intrinsically evil, right? It's nature, right? It's the nature of the Jew, right? The nature of the Jew to us as an existing force is bad or evil, right? Let's look at it maybe in this light. If we're in the forest, we're in the desert, let's say, and there's a pack of zebras and there's some lions in the brush, okay? And one of the lions eats one of the zebra, and all the other zebras scurry away. They don't rally around each other and go, "Oh wow, that lion was evil." You know, it's nature. It's what that lion is. It's what that lion has to do to survive, right? So, in a sense, what the Jew must do to survive is feed off of us and try to take advantage of us. What we must do to survive is break the yoke of Jewry. So it's like this. It's really the cycle of life, right? It's this back and forth and back and forth. It's like everything else in nature. There's like a harmonious balance between the two. Now, the way technology and man has excelled to such an extent, that seesaw is on the verge of having too much weight on one side or the other. And when that happens, I don't think the balance will ever remain again. So there is a time when one of those sides is going to have to give, and it's up to us to ensure that we are not the ones that give. That's the whole fight that we are in right now, is ensuring our existence by making sure that we maintain. Right now we have to maintain the balance, and then when we're done doing that, we must break the scale and ensure that we are imposing our will, right? As he says, the will to power, right? We must impose our will to power in order to put us in a position of authority over this situation.
Be something to it. If, in fact, people do like to create pain in others, of course, usually not themselves, what happens when you frustrate this desire? What happens when you say you can't enslave other people? You can't kill other people and take their possessions? You can't oppress other people because we will stop you? Well, Nietzsche says, and this is a fascinating possibility, although I'm not certain if it's true, he says that when people are frustrated in their desire to cause pain to others, the consequence of that is that they decide to start imposing pain on themselves. And this pain that they impose on themselves is called conscience. A horrifying possibility. In German, the term...
That's a very interesting line of thought. Really, that is actually an incredible line of thought. Nietzsche himself is actually a good example of this, right? His description of the hermit concept is characteristic of that, right? It's a man who is outcasted from society, recognizing that society does not have the capability of understanding his morality, because he's incapable of imposing that morality, because the society is a democracy, right? This is even Socrates' gripe, right? He's a brilliant man, but he's incapable of actually imposing his will onto society because it's a democracy. You're just a very small number amongst that very large pool of people in the system. So it's a very interesting thought. Never thought about that. This is very very thought-provoking, I got to say.
For the pang of conscience is called Gewissenbisse, which means the bite of conscience. And Nietzsche says essentially that people are predatory animals, and if they can't bite other people, they bite themselves. And when they begin to torture themselves, they find the last possible outlet for this desire to impose pain on the world. If they can't do it to other people, they'll do it to themselves. Now, this bite of conscience gets progressive.
I don't want to clarify, by this imposing pain on themselves, it's not talking about, you know, cutting themselves or hitting their head on the wall. What he's referring to is they're imposing psychological pain onto themselves, right? They're torturing themselves psychologically.
Progressively worse when priests come on the scene, when the priestly type comes on the scene. It goes from inferior to even more inferior, because the priests harness slave morality. They harness this morality of the herd, and they use it for their own purpose.
It's not about dominating bigots. So let's look at Hitler, for example, right? And National Socialist Germany. They weren't trying to dominate society, right? But they had to have that will to power in order for them to get the power, in order to impose, they have, so you have to have the will to power to then get to power. When you have power, then you use that will to impose genuine morality onto the populace, right? Without the power, they wouldn't have the ability to do that. So it's not domination. It's just simply will to power. Domination, there's a reason he words it will to power, because you have to impose your will to get into power, so then you can then use that will again and reimpose it onto the populace, right? And the idea is that's supposed to be for good. The problem is, in history, it typically has not been the case, but we want that morality to be imposed for the betterment of society. Love of our people with the 5 library coins. Thank you very much. He says, didn't Nietzsche have a very positive view of Jews? I wouldn't call it positive, no. He admired that will to power that they had, and that drive for passion, right? That passionate drive to attain power. That's what he admired about them. Which, to be entirely honest, it's very hard to refute that, right? If our people had half the willpower collectively that Jews have collectively, this would be done. We wouldn't even have this issue right now. We wouldn't even be thinking about this. I wouldn't be here. We'd all be in some lovely, thriving society. None of this shit would be a problem that we're experiencing today. None of it. So it's, you know, you have to at least point to that.
Purposes. The priests are the highest example of the herd animal, of the herd type. They have a special set of morals that they keep for themselves, and then they rule the herd using various kinds of myths and various kinds of verbal techniques so that they can have their revenge and so that they can oppose the warrior type. Nietzsche sees among the highest types of human beings an intrinsic conflict between the priest and the warrior. Nietzsche thinks that the warrior is the kind of person that knows how to forget things. Again, this is an interesting psychological profile. And there are many, incidentally, if you read The Genealogy of Morals and Beyond Good and Evil, you'll find that there are many anticipations of Freud, especially the question of conscience and the question of resentment. Nietzsche thinks that resentment, the hatred of being oppressed, is the source of slave moralities, and that the priest takes that resentment, formulates it in a mythological way, and uses that to orchestrate and control the herd so that they can be opposed to any superiority among those that would break moral rules, among the would-be warriors. Now, what makes the priestly type so dangerous is the fact that they can dominate culture and that they have chosen the wrong path. They have chosen the slave moralities and they have absolutized that. The consequence of absolutizing that is that it seems that there is no possibility of reintroducing master morality without a complete and thoroughgoing critique of the culture, and that is what Nietzsche thinks he is. That's what it means for Nietzsche to be the Antichrist. He's not just the Antichrist in some mythological sense. He literally takes that as a mark of distinction. It shows just what a free thinker he is. Nietzsche is willing to say not only is he the Antichrist, but that he thinks that that's the best development in culture since the time of Jesus. It's about time that we got back to a morality which would allow for the development of superior people. Now, Nietzsche's argument here is very disturbing. It's disturbing in its consequences. It's disturbing because it kind of rocks the moral boat for us. But Nietzsche's critique goes even further than this. He wants to investigate not just the question of pain and people's desire to impose pain on others, and if not on others, then on themselves. He wants to look at the arguments about suffering made by the priests. Christianity, if you remember, holds the view that God is providential, that he supervises the entire world, and that, I believe the phrase is, not a sparrow falls, but God knows about it. Well, Nietzsche thinks that this was invented so that suffering could be justified and could be explained. And in some respects, there's a certain amount of truth in that part of what Christianity does is explain or at least explain away the fact of human suffering by saying that God doubtless has some plan. Although we don't know what that plan is, it surely is there, because the kind of God we've decided to construct, the kind of God we believe in, is the kind of God, he's a good God, a loving God, the kind of God that would never do anything evil. Since he would never do anything evil, the suffering that you get must have a meaning. And Nietzsche thinks the worst thing that the priestly element ever did to human culture was to sell people on the idea that suffering has meaning. Nietzsche says that the entire world is completely meaningless, that the world is moral chaos, that suffering has no meaning, and the idea that suffering has meaning just makes suffering infinitely worse. It's not hard to see why.
That's a really good point that I actually really admire his description of this God's plan, right? God's going to come save everybody. We just have to put trust in that. That's a really big issue that we have as well, that is really present in specifically that evangelical camp, right? Those evangelicals think that Armageddon is the only way that we get out of the situation that we're in. We just need this, hypothetical second coming of Christ, and we're... Did we just get an entropy? Did I miss something? Why is that bar so big? Why is the entropy bar so large? Folks, did we have a donation come up on the screen? Do we have an alert? One moment. Seems like I've been signed out of Entropy. I don't know if it's just a glitch because of that. No, it's not. Give me some truth. Just give me some truth again. You have been so incredibly kind. Thank you very much. With another very generous $100 investment. I'm so sorry that didn't come up on the screen. I don't know why. Wow, folks. I'll tell you what. We're almost full on that bar today. If we fill that bar today, we'll do the bonus show for Sunday. I wasn't going to set that for today, but you guys have been incredibly supportive today. Just Give Me Some Truth says, another stellar show, Zach. Well done, my Jedi Master. I don't know if that's good or bad, Jedi Master. I don't want to be, is Darth Vader, he's got the Hebrew nameplate. That scares me. No, all jokes. Thank you so much. Very, 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 very kind. School of Fish, yes, I would really recommend reading some Nietzsche. Again, the three books that I recommend the most are Beyond Good and Evil, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and The Antichrist. They're very good works, very interesting and thought-provoking. Thank you guys again so much. We are at 160 out of 200 on that goal today. If we hit that goal by the end of the show, we will. I'll do a bonus show on Sunday. We've got 15 minutes left of the show, it looks like. But if we hit that goal, we'll certainly do an extra show on Sunday, because you guys have really been knocking it out with the support lately. I really do appreciate it, guys. All right, let's continue here. We're unfortunately not going to finish the video, but we'll get close.
It was bad when weak, feeble people had to put up with the strong, had to put up with having things stolen from them, with being murdered and raped and tortured. That was bad because of simple physical pain, for the reason that any natural calamity is bad. But the priestly idea of attaching a meaning to this suffering makes it all that much worse, because if there is a God in heaven who is in fact supervising this entire procedure, the reason why suffering must follow us, why evil must befall us, lies in ourselves. We are somehow responsible for it. We brought it upon ourselves. What does this mean? This infinitely increases our suffering, because not only are the weak and the feeble still being tortured and killed and raped and maimed, but in addition to that, it's their fault.
Love of our people. I will. I'll actually give you the link right now, so that you can view this video on your own. I'll put it in both the chat rooms. This is on Michael Sugrue's YouTube channel. Again, very brilliant guy. Has some seriously crazy philosophy videos on his channel. Really thought-provoking stuff everywhere. I have never seen a video of Michael Sugrue where I was disappointed. He had a brilliant mind. He really did.
What a horrible turnaround. What a dreadful addition to the suffering they already have. After you recover from a terrible encounter with warrior aristocrats, with those who are beyond good and evil, then you must live with the fact that you brought it on yourself, and guilt enters the world. After the superior, after the strong, after the ruthless have finished with you, after they've caused their modicum of pain, you have to add to it. The bite of conscience means you're going to impose pain on yourself. This development is one of the worst turning points in the history of Western culture, according to Nietzsche. And in that respect, Nietzsche believes that he is liberating us from the shackles of a self-imposed misery. And for all his madness, there is a certain degree of coherence in this argument. And it is hard to know where he's correct, how much of this we should accept, and how much of it is just speculation that we could never really have much of an idea about. So let's stop and think about it for a second.
Rosie put a lovely quote in the GTV chat. It says, the society that separates its scholars from its warriors will have its thinking done by cowards and its fighting done by fools. Very, very good quote. I really like that quote. And love of our people. I see your chat. Thank you so much. It's very kind. And I'm happy to be your favorite. Thank you.
My suspicion is that Nietzsche is probably wrong in his argument that good and bad come, or that our judgments of good and bad and good and evil come from the distinction exclusively of masters and slaves. Probably the distinction between good and bad is much older than aristocratic social structures, which are relatively late in human development, maybe 2 or 3,000 BC for the most part. What it most likely is attached to is feelings of pleasure and pain.
Yes, I agree. It's hard. I don't think he means in his own mind. I think he means societally. People no longer revere God in the way that they would, and especially it's far more so the case in our society today than it was even back then. We have a very atheistic society. It's a shame.
My guess is, again, just speculating a la Nietzsche, which would be very much in the Nietzschean tradition, that probably a full stomach was a good feeling and going hungry was a bad feeling. Probably breaking your leg was a bad feeling and being healthy was a good feeling. And these may well go before judgments of good and bad based upon aristocratic social structures. But the fact remains that after these initial judgments of pleasure and pain got turned into our judgments of moral value, there is a superimposed layer of aristocratic moral judgments in our culture and in our language. I think that the distinction between noble and base, between noble and mean, between high moral values and low moral values establishes that with a good degree of plausibility.
Yeah, certainly. Spy Hunter, he wasn't saying that he wanted God to be dead. He wasn't saying, this is my, this is how I feel. God is dead now. It can be confusing because he was calling himself the Antichrist, but what he was saying is he's the fulfillment of what Christians hate most, which is a man who is beyond that morality framework of this, very base good and evil. Love of our people, the five library coins, he says. Can we get the Romans in the chat for him? Thank you so much. He says, I think conscience emerges from human tribal society. It can be misdirected, though. Feelings of responsibility toward our own people is entirely appropriate. The problem is when conscience is perverted to pity the enemies of our tribe. Yeah, I would say it's perfect. Again, this is why we did this very long-winded discussion not long ago about the problems with multicultural society, but this is yet another symptom of that, right? Is we get in this spot where things that would be actually healthy instincts or healthy behaviors in a ethno state are actually really unhealthy and really damaging in a multicultural society. It's quite wild. Yeah, Nietzsche has got some brilliant takes. I don't agree with absolutely everything he says, but he's got some brilliant takes. You know, like most philosophers, there's a lot of good to take away, and there's a lot of stuff that you might want to weed out and save for somewhere else.
Now, what are we to make of this judgment? What happens when we go beyond good and evil? And this is a delicate and difficult question. Nietzsche, in a book called The Antichrist, which he modestly named after himself, one would think, he describes his procedure as philosophizing with a hammer. And that's a very intriguing idea because it shows the destructiveness of his philosophy, the skepticism of it, and the gleeful malice that's in it. And I think it's worth considering the fact that philosophizing with a hammer very easily shades over into intellectual vandalism. And it may be that not everything that can be broken ought to be broken. And it is not entirely clear that the Antichrist offers us more as a moral alternative than the Christian ethics. But his willingness to ask questions about it, I think, is what makes Nietzsche of enduring significance to our culture. For all the madness, for all the evil that's built into it, it's probably the most significant moral development since, the Enlightenment anyway. And in terms of its artistic qualities, I think that Nietzsche is probably in the same league as Plato. And as a great poet-philosopher, Nietzsche and Plato are the two greatest figures who combine art and philosophy. Those of you who have read Nietzsche will know that his critical capacity is awesome, and his artistic capacity is quite great. You would not find that primarily in his poems or in the songs that he writes. Most of the art that he creates directly is quite inferior. But his prose poetry is the greatest in the German language and probably the greatest in the Western tradition. Now, when we finish up with the priest and we find the liabilities of the priest, when we find that perhaps the priestly type has in fact been selling us a dangerous set of myths, we wonder if we can go back to the warrior. Probably not, except in a sublimated sense. If we were to take the will to power, turn it into something perhaps not as catastrophic as, Aryan war makers or superior brutish types, it may be that the type of the philosopher, that the type of the artist, is in fact the warrior type, the individual who needs no moral code to create his own conception of good and bad, that this type is what can come out of a revaluation of all values, and that, I believe, is what is advantageous in Nietzsche. The difficulty is how we will know when we really are beyond good and evil rather than being beneath good and evil. Many of Nietzsche's friends and his philosophical admirers have tried to shield Nietzsche from the criticism that he's a proto-Nazi. And in fact, I don't think it works. I think, in fact, Nietzsche is a proto-Nazi. There's a strong tinge of racism in his work. There is a strong tinge of refined cruelty in his work. And insofar as this was misused in the 20th century by the Nazis and by other racially oriented hate groups, I think Nietzsche is at least in part to blame. Those who...
All right, first bad take from Segru. First bad take.
Like Nietzsche's work, who want to shield her from this criticism, will point out with considerable justification that he would have nothing but contempt for the misuse of his work in this century. But it won't entirely absolve him of the results of his statements, because after all, Nietzsche would have had contempt for everybody, whether they like his, whether they adopt his position or not.
Nietzsche certainly was a proto-Nazi. I mean, if you look at his philosophy, if you read it and then you compare it to National Socialist values and philosophical takes, astonishing how similar they are to each other. It's quite evident they go hand in hand, certainly.
So I would say that the warrior type very easily shades over into the barbarian. And Nietzsche, as he puts it beautifully, says, "I write in order to be misinterpreted." And if we only have a series of misinterpretations of Nietzsche because he thinks that there is no one canonical interpretation, well then, it seems to me that he should bear the brunt of responsibility for everything, both good and bad, that comes out of his work. And if we live in a Nietzschean age, it seems to me that we have to find some way of tempering it with whatever it is that is good from the Western intellectual tradition. And if we can't agree as to what we want to call undesirable, whether it's good, whether it's bad or evil, whether it's the master conception of what's undesirable or the slave conception, we may perhaps be able to create a sense of the good which goes beyond the dichotomy between the two, which allows us to create some sort of overlap between them. Perhaps it would be possible, as Nietzsche says, to create an artistic Socrates, a moral Socrates, who is able to both combine the strength of the artist with the mythological capacities of the priest, who is willing to connect his individual judgment with the concern for what is good for the species. And I think Nietzsche himself would not have entirely disagreed with that. If one is going to create a beautiful, artistic philosophy the way Nietzsche does, we have to allow him a certain poetic license. If we are willing to allow Plato's poetry and Plato's myths a certain degree of consideration and a certain degree of leeway for interpretation, perhaps if we did that with Nietzsche, we would come up with a more fertile reading.
Alrighty, folks, we are coming up to the closing 5 minutes. I just want to give a little bit of an outro, and then we're going to get going for the day. Thank you guys so much for watching. This has been yet another very supportive, very fun show, and it felt like we covered some really good topics, as usual. Typically on these Tuesdays, I like to do the philosophical kind of thing, just because it is more podcast format for those listening over on Speak Free Radio. So one more time, I just want to promote everything, and then we're going to throw some music up, and we're going to get out of here, guys. So don't forget, if you guys are on Speak Free Radio and you want to catch me on everything else, it is GTV, Odyssey, and Gab, Logos Revealed on all of those platforms, and then you can also find me on Twitter, Logos at Logos Revealed with an I at the end of it. Thank you guys again for this show. Don't forget you can support this show and keep this show rolling via the links in the description. And that's about everything. The schedule was read off in the beginning of this show, and yeah, it's. I don't think I have anything else to really cover in that regard. So, thank you guys again for watching, and I will certainly see you guys very soon. I'll be live tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. I'm actually going live with G-Man, who's also on Speak Free Radio, and Euroweapon, the two of them. So that should be quite an interesting show as well. Spy Hunter with a $5 investment says, I like that. I write to be misinterpreted. In other words, I write because fuck you. Yes, Nietzsche was definitely playing a lot of mind games with his writing, that's for sure. Thank you guys again. I really do appreciate everybody that has been chatting, participating, supporting in any way, shape, or form. I will see you guys tomorrow at 5:30 Eastern. With a little bit of a miniature roundtable with G-Man and Euroweapon. That should be a pretty interesting and stimulating stream as well. So, all right, thank you guys. I will throw you guys some music, and we will be offline in about 3 to 4 minutes. Have a good one.